Built Not Born, episode 136. Hey everyone, it's Joe Ciccarone. Today's guest is Guy Kawasaki. Guy Kawasaki is a Silicon Valley icon. He is a renowned entrepreneur. Currently, he is the chief evangelist at Canva. Guy is also the creator of the Remarkable People podcast. Guy has such an amazing history. He worked alongside the legendary CEO of Apple, Steve Jobs, in the role of chief evangelist of Apple and was one of Apple's original employees. Guy played a pivotal role in marketing the first Macintosh computer. He was part of the Think Different campaign, which produced what many call the greatest Super Bowl commercial of all time. I'll put a link in the show notes. Still epic after all these years. Guy is also a prolific author. He is the author of such great books like Wise Guy, The Art of the Start, The Art of Social Media, Enchantment. Guy tells us how surfing conditions play a role when he schedules his meetings. How awesome is that? Guy talks about how he developed the growth mindset, why he took up surfing and ice hockey in his 50s, the books that changed the way he looked at the world, and of course, we got into some great Steve Jobs stories. I was so excited to get Guy on the show. I have admired his work from afar. Everything he writes, I read. He is so humble and classy. Just a great individual making the world a better place. So excited to bring you this interview. So I hope you enjoy. If you like what you hear, hit that follow button. Follow us on YouTube, or better yet, share this episode with a friend. We have a bunch of remarkable interviews like this one to come. Enjoy my conversation with the one and only Guy Kawasaki. And remember, life is built, not born.
All righty, here we go, baby.
Guy, how are you?
I'm good.
Thank you for joining. It's such an honor to speak with you.
I like your Aloha shirt.
Bought it in Oahu, maybe last summer when our family took a trip there.
Where are you now?
Oh, we're in Philadelphia.
Oh, that's a far way from Hawaii.
Beautiful island. Such a beautiful island.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Hey, so just so honored to have you on. Thank you so much for all your work. I've been following you since Art of the Start, Google Plus. Oh my gosh, read all your books. Wow. They're just so good. So good. Would love to just speak to you about Think Remarkable. Love your book and just walk through that and have you share your story with our audience, if that's okay with you.
All right. Let's do it.
Let's do it. I will get going. Guy, I appreciate you. Guy Kawasaki, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And anybody who wears an Aloha shirt is a good guy by me.
Guy, it's such an honor to have you on. Guy, for the listeners who may not be familiar with you and your work,
yeah,
who are you and what do you do?
Well, I'm the author of a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad. No, I'm not. That's Robert Kiyosaki, but I can't tell you how many times, seriously, how many times. Well, we're going to go off on a tangent already.
Let's go.
Control of this podcast, I hate to tell you. So
bring it.
I got to tell you this story. Dozens of times, people come up to me and they say, you know, Guy, man, I was lost. I didn't know what to do with my career. I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I was just floating, directionless. And then I read your book, and your book changed my life and helped me get my act back together. And so I say to them, so which one of my 15 great books was it that changed your life? And I'm telling you, they say, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I go like, oh, shit, you know? That's Kiyosaki. We all look alike. We all sound alike too. But this is Kawasaki, not Kiyosaki. So what was your question?
For the few people on the planet that don't know who you are, who are you?
Do? That's it. Who am I? So listen, my name is Guy Kawasaki. I am currently the chief evangelist of Canva. I'm the host of the Remarkable People podcast, and I'm the co-author of a book called Think Remarkable. And I used to be the Apple chief evangelist. I've been on the Wikipedia board of trustees. I used to work for the president of Motorola when it was part of Google. I used to be a Mercedes-Benz brand ambassador. So, I guess the most obvious two positions I had is chief evangelist of Apple and chief evangelist of Canva.
God, I would like to get into, one, your book, Think Remarkable. Such an amazing book derived from your podcast. We might even get into Wise Guy, one of my favorite books of all time. So maybe a couple of good Steve Jobs stories, if you wouldn't mind sharing them. But before we do that, I want to start back all the way from the beginning. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Honolulu, Hawaii, in a place called Kalihi Valley, which is a lower middle income. It's kind of tough part of Hawaii. So it's not like, I didn't grow up in Mar-a-Lago. Let's just put it that way.
I find like 10, 12 years old, very formative time in people's lives. I find the dinner table like a microcosm of your life at that moment. If you could think back to like 10, 12 years old, what was dinner time like for you? With your family, who was there? What was going on?
Well, you know, it was my father and mother and a sister, so it was four of us. And as I said, lower middle income. My mother basically dedicated her life to our family, and she was just a delicious cook. And my favorite thing that she makes is stew. I love stew. Anyway, so it was just like that, you know, small little Samsonite kitchen table in a small house, and rice and stew and pickled vegetables. I mean, that's it. Probably not unlike many other lower middle class families all over.
I appreciate you sharing that. So let's get to your book, Think Remarkable. Such a great book derived from your podcast, Remarkable People. The book includes like insights of, I think there's like 200 extraordinary, remarkable people like Angela Duckworth, Carol Dweck, Jane Goodall, Steve Wozniak. And you synthesize that through your filter of working with Apple, Google, Mercedes-Benz, Canva, Wikipedia. First, tell us, where did you get the idea of the book? You're doing the podcast. When did you realize, I got to do a book on this? How'd that come to be?
It was right around the time that the big advance came. Well said. Well, so listen, after 5 years, I have 200 and something episodes. So that's 200 and something hours of listening. And it's also, we transcribe every episode because I'm deaf. So I appreciate transcriptions. So it's now we have 4,000 pages of transcripts and, 250 hours of podcasts. And no one in their right mind is going to listen to 250 hours of a podcast or read 5,000 pages of transcripts. So we had to fix that. We had to take it down, and it's now about 170 pages, and you could probably read this book in 6 hours if you had to. And it's because I had such exposure to so much information and inspiration, I kind of felt like I had a moral duty to get it out in a format that more people could access it. And so I'm the author. This is my 16th book, so I know all about writing business books. And one of my pet peeves about business books is that a lot of times it's a 250-page book to explain one concept, right? So like, if you do things really a long time, you can make a really quick decision about stuff. Thank you very much. And if you try something and it fails, you should pivot really quickly. Oh, thank you very much. Or, get your prototype out to market, make it just a minimum viable product. Oh, thank you very much. But I just described about 2,000 pages of business books right there, right? So my book is 170 pages. We counted. It has 88 tactics explained in it. So each tactic gets roughly 2 pages, which I believe is probably the attention span of most people today. And my book, another of my peeves with business books is often they go pages and pages without headings, right? And after a while, you really need to read with a highlighter or a pen, because there's so much text in paragraphs. Well, my book is not like that. My book has headings. It has headings every single page. And within these headings, there are bullet points. And so my book has headings and bullet points because I want people to very quickly grasp what you have to do. And I don't want people wasting, you know, reading 250 pages to get one idea. I want them to read 2 pages to get that idea.
That's such a common trait from your books, like back to Wise Guy, Enchantment. They pack such a punch and they're not that thick. And there's so many, like you said, 88 tactical ideas in the very short book. Let's get to it. Here's a big question. How would you define being remarkable?
I define being remarkable as making a difference in the world. That is, you make the world a better place. And listen, my podcast, it's called Remarkable People, not rich people, not famous people, remarkable people. And I don't want people to get the impression that this book is designed only for the Steve Jobs and Jane Goodalls of the world, because I think you can make a difference with one person, one team, one classroom, cleaning up one stream. You don't have to be Steve Jobs or Jane Goodall. And I talk about many people that you will never have heard of that I happen to be fortunate enough to come across via my podcast. And those are the ones that are the most meaningful to me, the people who overcame homelessness or drug addiction. Or last night, I went to a gallery opening for a guy named Haleem Flowers. And at 16, he was sentenced to 40 years for accessory to murder. He got out after 22 years, and now he's such a powerful artist. And you know, that unless you're in the art world, and even if you are, you probably never heard of Haleem Flowers. And so I love to bring those kind of stories to light.
Yeah, sometimes the greatest stories of being remarkable or just grit, like the three traits you describe in the book, growth, grit, and grace, are from the people you never heard of. It's just the people, that hidden person, that mom, that daughter, the husband, the dad, the brother, who does things that are just so remarkable, so gritty, so graceful, but they're not famous, right? And then the podcast you have is trying to bring that to light. That's so cool. How about this first chapter? I love chapter one, Acquire a Growth Mindset. One person whose book changed the way I look at the world, Carol Dweck. You think of Carol Dweck and her remarkable book, Mindset. What did you learn from her? What has Carol Dweck taught you?
Well, Carol Dweck is the author of this book called Mindset. And this is an early 2000 book. And I consider her the mother of the growth mindset. And it was the realization that you can have a growth mindset or a fixed mindset. And the growth mindset means that you believe you can learn new things, you can acquire new skills. The fixed mindset means that you don't think you can, or that you have at all and you don't need to learn anymore. And that was a really powerful moment in my life when I read her book. And I figured out, you know, God, she's right, man. You can either have a growth mindset or you can have a fixed mindset. And some of the real tactical ramifications of that for me was that I took up ice hockey at the age of 44, having never skated in my life. And let's just say that's about 40 years too late. And then at 60, I took up surfing, and that's about 55 years too late. But, you know, in order to take up something like hockey or surfing at those ages, I can't think of a more tangible evidence of the growth mindset, because people at 55, they don't take up surfing. I mean, you know, they're basically watching Fox all day, right? I mean, so that's I rest my case. That's a growth mindset.
Oh my God. In surfing, so here's my surfing story. In Oahu, where we are in Waikiki, we're right in front of the Royal Hawaiian, and we've never surfed before. So we take the surfboards out, my family, 3 kids, my wife and I. This is last summer. We take it out. And they said, usually it's 2-foot swells. They go, today was 6-foot swells. They almost canceled our lesson. We never surfed. We go out in 6-foot swells. I have never been destroyed. Like, oh my gosh, so humbling. It's just so humbling. I think I rode at the very end of the hour, 90-minute lesson, whatever we had. I finally caught a wave. I caught one. and I'm riding it in. It's one of the best experiences I've ever had. And I go, you know what? My ego kicked in. I go, I'm going to ride this all the way to the shore. And I'm out, I'm riding. I had no idea you had a bail before the fins on the bottom hit the sand. I thought I was going to ride it right into the beach and kind of just like skateboard slide. It hits the sand. It was like a catapult. Like I was like thrown from the board, and I'm laying like from my hot, proudest moment of the summer to like, I'm laying like this. Oh my gosh. So humbling, so humbling, so humbling.
I think I saw you on YouTube. but you know what? Okay, let me tell you something.
Yeah,
I've done shit like that too. I mean, that you know, well, we laugh about it, but that shows a growth mindset, right? I mean, you could have said to your kids, "No, I don't want to do that. Daddy's gonna just sit here and you know read my Agatha Christie novel while you guys go off and surf, right?" But you, I can give you credit. I mean, first of all, you should not be taking your first lesson surfing in a 6-foot swell. Okay, that's just, I tell you something, the local surf instructors, they're saying, oh, look at his dumb howler. He's going out in a 6-foot swell. Let's go see what it is. I hope he didn't tip him. But
getting back to the hotel that night, right? So I don't know what I'm doing. I'm from Philly. First time I ever surfed. And I think I was like 50 when I was there for the first time. And I didn't know you have to go away from the impact zone to go back in line. So I'm like, I wipe out and I just go right down the middle a couple times. I'm back in the hotel and there's literally guys, I get the elevator. They're like, yo, man, you got to stop. You're entering the zone way wrong. I got yelled at like 3 times in the hotel. They recognized me as the guy paddling in as they're surfing. I saw the surfers coming by me. I'm like, how am I supposed to get out of here with all these people coming at me? It was, dude, like you said, it's so humbling.
But you know what? I have had the same warning. I mean, that's just part of surfing. You just, you know, it's no different than when you take up any sport, right? Like, you know, people tell you, yes, you just don't do that in hockey. You don't take a 10-minute shift or something. You like take a 2-minute shift and you get your ass off. I mean, you know, like other people are waiting for their shift. I mean, that's just the way it is. But like I said, I give you credit for even trying. I mean, there's a lot of people who don't try. And I can relate all of life to surfing metaphors, but
it's so true. And then the one that you mentioned in the book, Acquire the Growth Mindset, I love. You mentioned you can't be afraid to suck, right? Like you have to have the courage to suck at something, right? Like you have to say, I might be level 4 in some other part of my life, but I'm going to be level 0 in this, and I'm going to just get destroyed for a while. And you have to have the confidence to do that, right? Like the courage
to do
that.
That's true. You got to embrace your vulnerability. And that, you know, I think that shows humility. I mean, people just, there are a lot of people who don't have a growth mindset because, well, there's two things. One is the fear of embarrassment, right? Mm-hmm. So that's number one. But number two is that I think a lot of people with the fixed mindset, let's say they try surfing and, you know, they have a first day experience like yours. And they say, well, I'm not good at it. So obviously I wasn't meant to surf. So I'm giving it up. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? If you have a growth mindset, you understand that when you start anything, you're going to suck. Mm-hmm. Like very few people just take to anything naturally. And, you know, the first time they're great. So, I mean, sucking when you start is not the universe telling you to give up. Sucking is just telling you, the universe telling you that, you know, you got to pay the price.
You got to pay the price. That is so true. And that kind of goes right into your second chapter of the book, that embrace vulnerability. And I love one of the bullet points you mentioned in the book there. One, we learn from failure, but you have to brace for impact.
Yes.
You like gotta. From either surfing, crashing against the ground, or jujitsu, getting choked out. You have to have the ability to brace. You have to be comfortable, like brace for impact. It's coming because I jumped into something I suck at and I'm going to be vulnerable because I want to grow, but I'm going to get beat up doing this, right? Like you got
to. It's the same thing for entrepreneurship, right? You have to brace for impact because I tell you something, the first time you go out and pitch your company, mm-hmm. it's highly unlikely you're going to get the funding or the sale. Mm-hmm. You just need to be ready to be rejected. And you learn that in sales in particular. You know, sales is overcoming rejection.
Mm-hmm. And then you brought an interesting story. Could you tell how you learned to sell? I think I learned you were in the jewelry business, right?
Like, I was getting my MBA, I had a part-time job working for a jewelry manufacturer. And after I graduated, I actually went to that jewelry manufacturer when all my friends were going to Goldman Sachs and Accenture, McKinsey, and JP Morgan, and all that. And look who's here. So I went into the jewelry business, small jewelry manufacturer downtown LA that sold to retailers. And the jewelry business is hand-to-hand combat, right? I mean, it's like the buyer keeps you waiting and you're waiting outside with your suitcase and they keep you waiting for a few hours and they give you about 15 minutes and they don't give you an order or something like that. You learn to deal with rejection and you learn to deal with not giving up. And that's a very good training for life, man, because I tell you something, in life, you are always selling. I mean, it may not be selling in the sense of this is my commission, but you are selling when you apply for a job. You're selling when you apply for school. When you check in at SFO and you're telling the person checking you in, you know, can I get an aisle or can I get upgraded to first class? You are selling. If your lips are moving, you're probably selling. You're selling somebody on going out on a date with you, selling somebody on not leaving you. You're selling your kids on cleaning up their room. You're selling. Life is selling.
Yeah. We're all in sales. Like you said, everyone's selling an idea. You're selling something to your wife, your kids that brush their teeth when they're 4 years old, like your boss for a raise. Like you said, ticket counter person, can I get an upgrade? Like, we are all in sales. And sales gets such a, being in sales for 20 years, it gets such, like, you think of the used car salesman, the people that aren't in it, it has like a bad connotation, like, oh, he's in sales. Like, it's sometimes it doesn't have the greatest like reputation from the outside, but it's such a life skill, isn't it?
Listen, a good car salesman is a thing of beauty. I've had car salesman. I mean, it is an art. It is an art. It's not just shucking and jiving. I appreciate it. You know, as they say, the easiest person to sell to is a salesperson, right? I mean, that's so true.
There's a great quote from Nate Kawasaki. When you're getting hit with impact and failure and you're embracing something that you kind of suck at, Nate says, replace why this is happening to me with what is this trying to teach me? I thought that was such a powerful concept. Can you remember when that came about?
Well, he's 19 now, so he would have said it at 18. I can tell you something. It's not because of my DNA, because Nate is adopted. So he must have picked it up either from us or somebody else, but it ain't because of my genetics.
How about, I think this is chapter 3, Plant Many Seeds. You talk about pursuing interests, not passions.
Yes.
And then the big picture question attached to interest and passions. How can someone like Nate's age, like I have a son who's 19, I have another one who's in high school. How can someone find their true calling? Like, is it following their passion, pursuing interest? What would you recommend?
Well, my thing about the word passion is that it sets a too high bar and it sets expectations too high that, you know, you're supposed to find your passion and it's supposed to be love at first sight and it's supposed to be easy, right? So, you know, maybe that first day surfing, you found your passion for surfing and you pursued it the rest of your life, but most likely you got your ass handed to you and you're not sure you ever want to surf again, right? So I think instead of kind of setting yourself up for failure and finding your passions, you should just scratch your itches. Like, you know, oh, surfing looks interesting, I think I'll try it. Or podcasting looks interesting, I'll try it. Or writing or photography or, you know, I don't know, physics, violin, whatever it is. And I think you need to do a lot of sampling when you're, especially when you're young. You do a lot of sampling. Mm-hmm. And don't get so hung up that, you know, like you're 18 years old, you haven't started your not-for-profit in Africa yet, you haven't won a Nobel Prize. How are you going to write your college essay for Dartmouth and Yale? You haven't even started your non-for-profit yet. What the hell's the matter with you? Look, your classmates are getting into Ivy League schools with their college essays about how they went to Guatemala and they, you know, built the school. So get your act together, punk. And I mean, he's just setting people up for failure. You know? So just listen, you'll be lucky if over the course of your life, like let's say the first 90 years, if you find three or four passions, you're fortunate. Mm-hmm. But to find those three or four passions, you probably have to look at 10 or 15 interests.
And that's where you mentioned you have to plant many seeds, right? Like just kind of see what sprouts, right?
Right.
That's such good advice. And then you get to the end where you have good intentions and you're trying things out. Your writing is just so on point, so tactical. Like chapter 4, you mentioned do good shit, the name of the chapter, do good shit. Action and implementation is everything. If you have theory, you have, I'll think about it. I think I might do this one day. Could you speak of the benefit of taking action?
Well, you know, even if you're interested in something, I guarantee you, even an interest is not going to turn into a passion unless you actually do it. Right? Like, mm-hmm. You may be interested in surfing. You can watch all the YouTube videos you want about surfing, but you got to get your ass in the water. And, you know, lots of people saying, oh, I want to be an entrepreneur. I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking about that. And 5 years later, they're still thinking about it. I mean, at some point, real men ship. I mean, real men, they get in the water. Real women, too. But
yeah. It sounds like Seth Godin. I remember Seth. He's been a guest of the show a few times. And Seth's like, art is not art until you ship it out into the world, until it crashes into the marketplace, right? And the chapter, I would say, get beyond Eureka. Not only you have to make the right decisions, but at some point, you got to savor the shit sandwich, right? Like what it's trying to teach you. Sometimes you got to prove your concept. And a lot of times you got to eat a lot of shit before you prove your concept, right?
Yeah, so this is from Mark Manson, the author of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a You-Know-What. And he told me, guy, you know, you will really understand that you love something, that it's, you know, gone beyond interest and it's your passion when it involves what many people consider a shit sandwich, but you love the shit sandwich. So, I mean, you as a podcaster, you know that podcasting has a lot of shit sandwiches. It's
crazy.
Research, it's editing, the recording, and in from the outside looking in, that doesn't look like fun. But if you're a podcaster, that's the shit sandwich that you love. And also, if you're a writer, writing involves hundreds of hours of editing. And from the outside, you know, you think writing is just getting your Mont Blanc pen with an 18-karat gold nib and the words just flow on the page, but that's not how it works. And so that's a very good litmus test for, have you found your calling, your passion, you know, your true interest in life is when it involves a shit sandwich and you love the shit sandwich. I mean, you could make the case that life is about finding shit sandwiches that you like.
Yeah, it's almost like that stoic thing where we control the process, but not the outcome, right? Like like as long as you control the process, and the process can become really shitty at times, but if you enjoy that and can keep eating those sandwiches and you go through the grind, like you'll find the outcome at some point will take care of itself, right? It might not be exactly where you think you're going, but it'll bring to something really good, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
I love the story you told. It might have been in chapter 8, Take the High Road, about paying back to society. Was Mark Benioff, the leader of Salesforce, one of your interns, or you work with him? Could you share that story? He helps you out years later. I just found that really just a stand-up dude.
So, when Mark Benioff was in college at USC, between his freshman and sophomore year, he was an intern for me at Apple, and we used him to write assembly language programs for Macintosh to show people what it was like to write an assembly language program. And decades later, he's now the founder and CEO of Salesforce, and, you know, billionaire, and tallest building in San Francisco, just a whole shooting match, right? And I reach out to him first for Mike Boych, the guy who hired me at Apple. His son wanted to work at Salesforce. And then about a year later, my son wanted to work at Salesforce. And in both cases, I sent an email to Mark Benioff. And, you know, half an hour after I send that email to Mark Benioff, the VP of HR sending me an email say, okay, you know, we're going to set up an interview for your son or your friend's son. And like, this is literally decades later, and Mark Benioff did not have to do that. And I, frankly, I'm not sure I would have done it if I were him. So yeah, that's taking the high road. That's remembering your friends.
Man, I mean, someone at that level, getting involved with basically an entry-level position through one email because you worked with them 20 years ago. And like, what a stand-up dude. I mean, that is a stand-up guy right there. Wow, that's
He really, you know, he really is a stand-up dude. And let me just say that there's a shortage of stand-up dudes who are worth $1 billion.
I heard that rumor. I've heard the rumor.
May we someday find out.
Oh my gosh, no kidding. I know, that would be great to find out at some point. So speaking of $1 billion, could you share the story of the Macintosh Think Differently campaign where you said you might've lost a few $100 million in stock options? It's one of my favorite Steve Jobs stories you told. Could you tell that Steve Jobs story?
Yeah, so the year is 1997 and you know that's when Apple is supposed to die. And Steve was coming back to Apple, and Lee Klow from Shiat Day, the ad agency, came up with this idea for the Think Different ad campaign. And this is the campaign that featured pictures of Albert Einstein and Nelson Mandela, Amelia Earhart, Richard Branson, Pablo Picasso. Because the thinking was, if you're like these leaders and these innovators and these change makers, you thought different. You didn't just go with the crowd and use a Windows machine. And so Lee Klow chose this campaign to a room of 10 people with me and Steve and marketing staff. And we all love the campaign. And at the end, Lee Klow says to Steve, I got two copies of this videotape. I'll give one to you, one to Guy. And Steve Jobs says, don't give Guy a copy. Just give both copies to me. And I said, so Steve, is it because you don't trust me? And he said, yeah, Guy, I don't trust you. And then so now you have to understand, this is a man or mouse moment, right? This is the kind of moment you look back in your life, and to use a surfing analogy, you know, so you turn around and you see this big wave coming at you and it's perfect. And you think, am I going to paddle for that wave or am I just going to be a wimp and dunk and just dive under it? So this is one of those kind of moments. So Steve says, yeah, God, I don't trust you. And I fulfilled my role and I said, Steve, it's okay because I don't trust you either. So it probably cost me a few tens of millions of dollars, but what a great story. What a great story, huh?
Oh my God. I don't think too many people have talked to him at that way at that point. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but you know what? A few years later, he offered me another job, but me, the dumbass, I turned him down again. So
that moment, talk about no one really knows what's happening, and even the experts don't know what's happening. At that moment where Apple was on the ropes, right, before the Think Different campaign, wasn't another billionaire, Michael Dell, said, like, Apple, what was the quote by Michael Dell?
Oh, so Michael Dell said something to the effect of, you know, it's hopeless for Apple. Apple should take the cash it has, give it back to its shareholders, and close up shop.
What year's this? And this is what? When is this?
Had to be around 97 or so, right?
Oh my gosh. Before that.
I'm sure you can find that quote. I bet you can find that quote when Michael Dell said that.
That's crazy. Before the iPhone, before like the iPad. That is so crazy. Oh my gosh. Talk about not knowing. Like you said.
You know, I think one lesson I took from that is, if you don't have something positive to say, you should just shut up, because you never know who's going to disprove you, right? You shouldn't say, who is this punk Mark Benioff, freshman at USC? He's never going to amount to anything. And then, holy shit, he's a billionaire. And, you know, he can buy and sell you a guy with what's in his ashtray and his Mercedes Benz. And, you know, just shut up.
That's good advice. Not nice to say, say nothing. Speaking of Steve Jobs, such a legendary figure, if you could give like two things you learned from him that are positive And then one thing you're like, you know what? I could probably make an adjustment from that. What would be your learnings of what to do and what not to do from Steve?
Well, you know, certainly I learned that design counts, right? I mean, Macintosh, all of Apple is testimony that design counts. Second thing I learned is that if you get people to believe in your dream, they will be your customer. They will buy what, you know, if you get people to believe in a graphical user interface, get to believe that that power should be accessible, that it shouldn't be dependent on a centralized IT department. You get to believe, you get people to believe in that, they'll buy your computer. A negative thing that I learned is Steve was an asshole. He was a mission-driven asshole, but he was an asshole nonetheless. And I would not be where I am were it not for Steve Jobs. I owe him. I think that it was an honor and a privilege to work for him. But let's just call a spade a spade. He was an asshole. And I don't think that that is necessary nor sufficient to be a successful entrepreneur. And Melanie Perkins, the CEO of Canva, is proof that you don't need to be an asshole to be a successful CEO. Mm-hmm. So that's something that, you know, is something I learned in a negative sense from Steve.
Wow, that's great. No, thank you, for sharing that. That's amazing.
Can I tell you something? So,
yeah,
believe it or not, I'm deaf. And so I am doing this podcast with a cochlear implant, and that's how I can hear. Otherwise, and right now it's transcribing. Do you see the transcription? Well, so believe it or not, I forgot to charge my cochlear implant battery last night, and the battery died. So I'm reading the transcript of what you're saying to understand what you're saying. So I'm just telling you, that's what's going on right now. So it's really hard.
Well, one, that's incredible. I could not tell at all. And you are such a baller. Oh my gosh.
I don't know if that's a good testimony to Zoom's live transcription or my incredible intellectual powers, but it is a challenging situation for me right now. I gotta go get another battery.
That is remarkable, to say the least. Guy, how about this? I wanted to turn this over to a part of the interview we call Share Your Secrets. Just some fun questions to throw at you so the listeners can get to know you a little bit better, if that's okay with you.
Okay.
How about this, Guy? When you need to clear your mind or recharge your body, what do you do?
Well, the answer to that should be obvious. I surf. I surf almost every day.
Awesome.
Literally, almost every day. I take a break from surfing to write and speak and podcast. And I'll tell you another story. Don't spread this around too far.
I promise.
Did Madison schedule you for me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So Madison is also a surfer. And so she understands. And we never schedule interviews when surfing conditions are good. So the fact that we're doing this right now is because it's high tide here and it's not good for surfing. So if it was low tide and good for surfing, we wouldn't be on this call right now. Seriously, that's how I schedule my meetings.
That might be the highest form of success and freedom, where you could schedule your work around ideal surfing conditions. That is awesome, Guy. That's so good. You mentioned a lot of great books. In one, you wrote a lot of great books, Wise Guy and Think Remarkable, one of them. And you mentioned a lot of great authors that you've interviewed. What book most influenced your life or changed your mind more than any other? If you had to recommend a book or two to someone, what would you recommend?
I would say that the book that changed my life the most is If You Want to Write by Brenda Yulin. That was written for writers, but you substitute any creative endeavor for the word write. If you want to program, if you want to make movies, if you want to write poetry, if you want to take pictures, I mean, just substitute whatever you want to do for the word write, and that book will empower you to look beyond the negativity and look beyond even the negativity in your own head to be a writer, to be a videographer, to be a movie maker, to be a photographer, to be a painter. A second book that really fundamentally changed my life is Mindset by Carol Dweck. A third book is Grit by Angela Duckworth.
I've never heard of the Brenda Yuler book until you mentioned it in Think Remarkable. Mindset and Grit are two of the books that just, I'm with you, changed the way I looked at my professional and personal life. They are so
good. Know, another great book is Influence by Bob Cialdini.
Really? Okay. I'm not familiar with that.
Your sales and marketing, right? Everybody should read Influence by Bob Cialdini.
I will put all of them in the show notes. Thank you for sharing that. How about this? We spoke about a lot, your time with Apple, Canva, Steve Jobs, surfing. If you could have everyone listening take just one lesson away from everything we discussed, what would that lesson be?
I think it would be that if you want to be remarkable, the way to be remarkable is to make a difference. It's not to, quote, be remarkable. It's to make a difference. And you make a difference by making the world a better place, and the world will have no choice but to consider you remarkable. So the way to be remarkable is make a difference.
Wow, make a difference. Great. Here's a fun one. Sometimes this question works. Sometimes it doesn't. How about this?
It'll work. I guarantee it. Everything works with me.
Awesome. Guy Kawasaki, if you could spend the day with anyone, alive or dead, famous, not famous, who would you spend the day with?
Nelson Mandela.
Oh, that's a good one.
Mandela.
What would you do? How would you spend your time with him?
Well, I mean, think about, you know, him being in prison for decades, and think about, you know, him not hating white people coming out. Well, I mean, I don't know if he hated white people coming out, but it would certainly be, I think, very, very interesting and very insightful about being remarkable to spend a day with Nelson Mandela.
That would be amazing and remarkable.
I bet you thought I was going to say Donald Trump, right?
You and Donald and Mar-a-Lago. How great would that be? Like on the boat or something? That would be perfect. I would pay to see that picture. That would be awesome. How about of all, as you look out to the year ahead, Guy, what's the most exciting project you're working on now?
You think I plan my life 1 year in advance? I hate to disappoint you. I mean, okay. I'll give you a very good metaphor, especially if you're a mother.
Okay.
So here's the metaphor. 2 weeks ago, I gave birth to a book. Okay. And I did it without an epidural. It was just natural trial birth, breathing deeply, pushing that baby out. So 2 weeks later, you're asking me, when are you going to get pregnant again? Let me tell you something. I'm not thinking about being pregnant again right now. Okay. I'm still in postpartum.
That is perfect. Oh my God, it's the perfect answer. Thank you. How about this? Last question. Guy Kawasaki, if you had to get a quote or a saying tattooed on your body, what would that quote or motto say?
It would be empower people. That's what I want to be remembered for, empowering people. That's my reason for living. And, you know, at this point in my life, and that's what I want to remember for. Everybody needs to have a goal in life, and that's my goal. I want to empower people. So, how's that?
I think empower people is about as good as a spot as any to wrap this up. Guy Kawasaki, I'd like to thank you for showing.
I'm trying to send you one link here.
Yeah.
So, in addition to the book, Canva and I created this course, online course. It's a free course on how to be remarkable. Because not everybody likes to read, and, you know, not everybody's going to buy the book. I still want you to be remarkable. So, tell people about this free Canva course.
Absolutely. I will put that in the show
notes. I prefer to buy the book. But
the book is amazing. You could read it in like a day or two. There's so many actionable tactical strategies, tactics, and ideas to get you unstuck in life or give you the courage to jump into something. So good. Guy, I'd like to thank you for showing us all what's possible in this crazy world we live in. You show us how to make a difference, how to live a remarkable life. I want to take a quote from Jane Goodall, who does the foreword for your book. Jane says, Guy Kawasaki writes not just a self-help book. It challenges us not only to improve our own individual lives, but to create a positive impact in the world around us. And I think that leads into this great Anne Frank quote that you shared. It's wonderful to think that some of our best days are still in front of us. And possible for people like you, Guy, for sharing how to operate better in this world. I'd like to say mahalo, aloha, and you are welcomed in our ohana any day of the week. Appreciate you, dude. Thank you for all your work and illuminating the path and just for everything you do, man. I appreciate you. Just much respect.
Oh, you know, you're very kind. I mean, it just made my day. Thank you very much. And Jane Goodall is one of the people I most admire in the world. So, yeah, I've had a remarkable life, and I don't mean that in the sense I'm bragging. I've been very, very fortunate. And so I'd like to spread the aloha a little bit. So, okay.
Okay.
I got a battery on my freaking cochlear implant so I can hear the next interview. My God.
Thank you, Guy. Thank you so much.
I'm the first deaf person you interviewed. Okay. All the aloha. Best. Have a great Easter.
Appreciate you. Bye, guys.
Bye.